This is Vibrock Telluride Inside and Out. I'm speaking with Dr. Doty, Dr. James Doty, who is a professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University School of Medicine and the founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. He will be in town heading up the largest conference of its kind of like-minded scientists who have been studying the impacts on the body and on the mind of compassion, altruism, and meditation. That event takes place in two parts. The festival is Wednesday, July 18th, and then the conference begins on July 19th and runs through Sunday, July 22nd. It is co-hosted by Stanford University and the Telluride Institute. Dr. Doty, thanks so much for joining me.
It's really a pleasure, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So how did you, a neurosurgeon, become involved with the study of compassion, and how did that lead to the center you founded at Stanford?
Well, I'll give it to you in a nutshell. I grew up in poverty with a father who's an alcoholic and a mother who is an invalid, and was on public assistance my entire life growing up. And I was always interested in the reality that I would see people with means, wealth, power, position, who would see people suffering and do nothing, and the paradox of people who had nothing who gave everything. And it stayed with me into my adulthood. And when I got into a position to really start thinking about this, and I think it came both with life experience and also being at the right place at the right time, at Stanford, I just began having informal conversations and eventually convinced some of my colleagues in the field of psychology and neuroscience to work with me to look at some of these questions. And ultimately, that became what we called Project Compassion, which was really my informal working with these scientists doing some preliminary studies. And then ultimately, I wanted to have the Dalai Lama actually visit Stanford to talk about compassion, since certainly he's an individual who I think anyone would acknowledge is really epitomizes compassion. And so ultimately I met him. And in our conversation, the very first one we had, he became very excited. And at the end of the conversation, not only did he agree to come to Stanford, but spontaneously he gave me the largest donation he had ever given to a non-Tibetan cause. And that really was the first spark of actually creating a formalized center. And shortly thereafter, two individuals gave significant amounts of money. And at that point, the dean said, well, this needs to be formalized. We really need to turn this into a real center, not just simply an informal group of people doing some preliminary work. And that ultimately led to the creation of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, which is part of the Neuroscience Institute at Stanford.
Okay. Thank you for that. And could you describe the circumstances that brought you to Telluride 3 years ago for the first conference and your reaction to our little box canyon?
Well, it's interesting. There was a young man whose name is Joel Finkelstein, and his parents actually, or I should say his in-laws, actually are the founders of the Telluride Institute.
Right.
And in our conversations, when we were just first talking about doing the conference, Pam and John were actually introduced to me and were quite excited about the work we're doing and, in fact, made a significant donation to that work. And then this began a dialogue, and when it came to the point of doing the very first conference, they said, it would be wonderful if you could do it in Telluride. And I had been there previously and had loved the place and the ambience and the people and, if you will, the vibe. And there you have it.
Okay. And I was there, and I saw the absolutely amazing things that happened in the crowd at almost every single presentation by every single person on the podium the very first year. And it was standing room only. The crowds were pouring out onto the streets, or pouring in from the streets.
Exactly, yes.
So Okay, let's switch gears a little bit for a little more framing and a little more context. About 5,000 or so years ago, the yogis figured out that their transformational practices would have major impacts, or could have major impacts, on anatomy, physiology, and psychology. What do you think took the West so long to catch up and put scientific diligence to ancient disciplines like yoga, meditation, altruism, and compassion?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, there is oftentimes a feeling, and we have seen it demonstrated through colonialism over centuries, that somehow the West has more intelligence, more insight than any ancient culture. It's an arrogance and a lack of humility that actually obviously is quite wrong, but unfortunately, because of the power of the West, in part because of the Industrial Revolution and other factors and the economics, they were able to spread themselves throughout the world and to some extent impose their will. And in the process, it was always we are right and you are wrong, and there's really not a whole lot that you can contribute to our culture or society. And that has been the problem. It has only been through the diligence of an incredible number of people who early on understood the value of these ancient wisdom traditions, and a number of scientists who have, over the last several decades, have really taken a great deal of interest in these practices, which you have pointed out have had great effect in the context of just self-improvement. And I think we're almost at a tipping point where these practices are now being able to be understood based on science and their actual effect on a deep level. And we're seeing through science with objective measures the positive impact. And I think now not only are we much more humble, but the reality is that now that science demonstrates this, we are much more accepting.
Wonderfully said. Thank you very, very much for that. So have your studies found that even small acts of compassion, and this may be overreaching to call this an act of compassion, but like buying a friend a cup of coffee or picking up a hitchhiker, as we often do along the roads on Telluride, do those sorts of things make a difference at the level we're discussing, at the level of physiology, at the cellular level? And if they do, is there a cumulative effect? I mean, can you start putting these little acts of kindness in some kind of emotional bank and you actually start feeling better and experience some of this transformational power through small acts?
No, I think actually that's well said, and that's exactly right. And it's not so much studies we've done, but some of my colleagues. And there is no question that repetitive acts of kindness, number one, strengthen your own compassion, make you feel better on multiple levels, mental and physical. And when people observe people doing compassionate acts, it actually stimulates them to be more compassionate. So, if you will, it's a win-win for everyone. The other thing I will tell you, if you think about it, you know, all of us have been in situations where we've needed other people and feel like we've exhausted every resource available. And think about how you feel when you're in that position. You're isolated, you're alone, you're depressed, you feel that there's no God, and then someone intervenes. And how suddenly the clouds part and you feel good and you feel loved and you feel cared about. And then the deep, long-lasting effect of when you actually are the person who does that intervention. And that's true happiness, that's true compassion, and that is a very long-lasting, positive, deep feeling.
I want to get a little bit scientific with you. And so I have two questions around the science. Is there a gene, a single gene, that's been traceable to things like compassion, or is it sort of a multitude of genes that seem to work in concert?
Well, a couple answers to that. One is we're at the beginning of this exploration, but as an example, though, of at least some of the hints about this, there is a gene that is associated with the hormone oxytocin, which some people have called the nurturing hormone or the love hormone, and is associated with bonding. And there are people who have a different gene expression of that, and these people are, in fact, less compassionate and respond completely differently in regard to social interaction to those who have a different form of that gene. So there is no question that gene expression plays a significant role. We're just at the earliest stages of defining what those genes are, and it's certainly, while oxytocin is an important hormone, there are certainly others such as dopamine and serotonin. And in fact, we're doing a study at Stanford right now looking at some of the gene expression in rodents in regard to nurturing type of behavior. And it's a very, very complex interaction.
Fascinating. So you have, however, looked. You may not know the what's actually triggering the compassion and why it's more in some people, less in others, but you've measured the impacts of the of acts of compassion, as you also have meditation and altruism and even certain yoga practices. I know you have. I know the studies have come out of Harvard, Stony Brook, the University of Wisconsin with Richard Davison, UCLA. So is it all about looking at the results through brain scans, or are there other scientific methods being brought to bear?
Well, you know, it's interesting you bring this up, because one of the things that is the purpose of this conference, which is called Science of Compassion, Origins, Measures, and Interventions, is to think about all the different ways. Certainly brain scanning is one. One, are there are certain behavioral tests or psychological tests. Another is what we call self-report. And then other is physiologic, either as an example, galvanic skin response, or actually blood measures, certain types of hormones such as cortisol and its effect, which is associated with stress, of course, or measures of the immune system, such as interleukin-6. And so, and we're finding others that, it's going to be a combination of things, and we're using the term a compassion measurement index, and then really trying to figure out what the best combination of measures are, and then use that, hopefully have it utilized by all the different researchers in this area, so that we can have consistency across the board, so that we can compare apples to apples and oranges to oranges, versus what is in part happening in that one particular investigator has picked out what he has decided in his own view demonstrates compassion, although there's no group of things that everyone agrees upon. So you see from lab to lab different measures used with different types of studies. And it would be wonderful if, and I hope this conference is at least a stimulus to have the conversation about, should we try to get more consistency and understanding of what really comprises a compassion measure?
Okay. Could you give one example as to how compassion can be cultivated and maintained? So how do you teach it?
Well, you know, from an evolutionary perspective, we are designed, if you will, for social connectedness. You know, the cost of the development of our cortex in regard to cognitive function or abstract thinking or language or, if you will, theory of mind resulted in us having a prolonged gestational period and the requirement outside of the womb for us to be nurtured for years. And that same powerful nurturing mechanisms are apparent in us today. And we know that by thinking of, as an example, those who you care about most, if you will, your nuclear family, who you love very deeply, if you then think about the next group and say, can I extend that love to, let's say, more just social acquaintances, that same depth of love and caring that I do for a family member, and then once you've been able to do that, extend it to those who you may not know and say, you know, the reality is I love everyone. I care about everyone at a deep level. I know they want what I want, which is happiness for themselves, their family, for their loved ones, and I believe that they will want that for me. And as you extend this outward circle, if you will, an ever-enlarging circle to essentially encompassing everyone on this earth, then you are a bodhisattva and you are
right.
A king of compassion, if you will. But that's the challenge is to, for those you don't care about, to actually care. For those who don't necessarily believe what you believe, for those who have different biases or different points of view, where you still engage them with an open heart and not automatically put your defenses up. And each time you do that, it actually, as we were talking about, strengthens itself. One of the things that I do myself, which I find helps me get in the right mood every day and puts me in the right frame of mind, is I actually go through this part of the alphabet, which is CDFGHIJKL, which is I start with compassion and thinking about people in that regard. I think about dignity of every human being. I think about equanimity, realizing that in all of our lives we're going to have ups and downs and we have to look at in a broader way where we're accepting both the ups and the downs. Forgiveness, where we cannot go forward unless we forgive ourselves and we forgive others. Gratitude, a sense that we are thankful what we have been given, because in most cases in America, all of us are better off than 90% of the rest of the world. Humility, understanding that our version of things is not the only version of things, that we can learn something from every person we interact with and learn something very positive on a multitude of levels. Integrity, having integrity as to who you are as a person. Justice, the concept of social justice for everyone and not just your own group. And kindness, looking at everybody in a kind way. And lastly, of course, and most importantly, love.
Okay. Well, the implications for your work, I needn't tell you, I'm sure it's in front of your face every day, are wide-ranging for a world that feels quite broken and quite polarized. So I hope that you'll explore that subject, which goes into the socio-political realm, at your conference and at the festival. So I want to thank you for your time. This has been Susan B. Brock-Telliwright, Inside and Out, speaking with Dr. James Doty, Professor of Neurosurgery, Stanford University, founder and director of the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, and a driving force along with the Telluride Institute for bringing one of the most momentous conferences this town has ever seen. And it's happening beginning on July 18th, both at the Sheraton Opera House and the Palm Theater. And it runs through the weekend. Dr. Doty, thanks for taking the time out of what I know is a hectic schedule to talk with me.
Well, Susan, thank you so much, and it's very kind of you to have me. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Take care.